The following presentation was recorded at a science workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
What I'd like to do before I get started is take a little poll here from you so I know who I'm addressing today. How many of you teach a science class in school? Any science class? Okay, how about how many elementary science teachers are here today? Elementary teachers. Okay. 9 through 12. The rest of you, 9 through 12. How about, do I have any teachers who are from ACE school? I know one. Are there any other ACE teachers here? ACE school teachers. Okay. I might just make a few comments at the end about some things you can do for some of your classes. I want to share a verse with you that I enjoyed this past week. I came to know this verse. I knew the latter part of this verse, but I suspect you're familiar with it as well. It's found in Daniel 12, verse 3. And I had always known that the latter part of the verse, but I never really looked at the first. So let's look at this together. Those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heavens, and those who lead the many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever, forever and ever. I'd always heard that end, like the stars forever and ever, right? I think the King James says those who have wisdom will shine brightly. And if you look up that word wisdom, do you know what it means? Anybody know? Those who are instructors, those who are teachers. And that was just kind of a challenge or an encouragement to me as I was starting one night. I had to think of all my lesson plans I need to get ready for the next day and so on. And it was an encouragement to me, and I thought I'd share that with you. The work that we do here on earth is important. And I think, obviously, Scripture here is speaking of those who are instructors of righteousness. But we can be instructors of righteousness in our science classes as well. What I'll be doing is sharing, can everyone hear me okay from here? I think I'll stay here. I'll be sharing with you the ideas that have worked for me. And I love science. I enjoy this immensely. And I'll just share with you some of the ideas that I've gotten my students excited about, and hopefully you can do the same. I'm sure some or many of you have already. What I did this week, I asked my students to write down on a piece of paper some things that they remember particularly from their science career, I call it. They like the word science career. And from all the way from, you know, elementary grades up to where they were at. This was 9 and 10, 11 and 12 mainly. And I like to just share a few of their responses with you. Carolyn says, hands-on learning, such as mounting bugs. Enjoyed when we went on field trips. Learning how different organs work, such as your heart, muscles, and lungs. One of my favorite ones is this. Mary says, enjoyed gathering and observing flowering plants, also dissecting frogs and pigs. But next time, forget the earthworms. I love the eye. It was so cool. And it helped me see how eyes work. I never knew it had all that jelly goop in it. So I had to go with that one. Keith says, or Michelle here, one of the things I enjoyed most about my biology classes were the dissections. When I do hands-on work, it helps me learn things better and know exactly what they are and where they are. It is so much easier than trying to learn off of an illustration in a book. And I do want to read Keith here. He lists six. Dissection lab, microscope lab, field lab, class discussion, organized comprehensive notes. So that's the burden on us teachers, right? Being able to understand DNA, RNA after class. When going in, I was completely lost. So then let's go down to 9 and 10. I was 11 and 12 there. 9 and 10, they had a competition. Whoever come up with 20, I say, if they come up with 20 reasonable things they enjoy, I'll give them an extra one quiz grade. So I had three students who came up with 20. Going on walks and see the things that you study about, insect collections, big science projects. Last year they did a science project. Identify birds, bring in live demonstrations, dissect things, plants, animals, gather press identified plants, build a model, have exhibits, do science news articles, and she goes on all the way to 21. So I'll have this up here. If you want to look through here, some of them are funny. Some of them are, I don't know if they enjoyed it or not. They just wrote something down. But you look through here if you want, and then you get some ideas. I have to maybe just mention some of the experiences that helped me enjoy science were when I was in school. And I had two teachers in particular. And I, looking back, I think it was more the person than it was the subject. In other words, I knew they were excited about science, and it's hard to get someone excited about something you're not. And Luke Beiler was probably the most influential man in my life other than my father, and he was into science, so maybe that's why I enjoy science too. Another man helped me really, he collected things. He collected animals and everything, so maybe that's why I do it too. He influenced me. I took a pattern after him. So what I'd like to do is maybe share just some of the ideas that I have. I have a handout for you, so why don't I get that, and we've got the two volunteers to pass it out. And just take one of those. Now that's just a worksheet, and you try to write some things down. I'm going to fill in there. And we'll go ahead and get started here with science, biological science. One of the first things I always ask my students when I start a class year is I ask them, I ask for definitions of biology, when we're studying biology. And 9 and 10, they often have a hard time, and then I have them break it down, like what all this, you know, study of life. So what all are living things? Well, what kinds of living things can you study? And so we identify what's living, what's not. And so basically we're going to break it down into botany, zoology, human anatomy, physiology. And then I'll come back maybe a little bit with cytology to study it about. So maybe to begin, on top there of your handout, you have science is best learned with hands-on activity. And I really can't stress the importance of that. It's been mentioned several times, but science has to become alive, literally, for your children. Your students. They have to be able to reach into a jar and see a little snake, you know, pull it. And they have to be able to get, they have to be able to get, you know, the thrill of seeing him get loose in the class and see where he's going to go next, right? So they have to get the thrill of seeing the tarantula, you know. I almost brought him this weekend while I was in the home.
You know, and then half of them want to hold it. The girls want to hold the tarantula.
So science, and especially life sciences, are best learned hands-on. Okay, you can have illustrations of tarantulas in your book, but why not buy one for $8 at a pet store? Or better yet, get your students excited about it. And I didn't even have to buy the tarantula. One of my students bought it, and she left it at school. And at the end of the year, I inherited it. So if you get your student excited, they'll start bringing in gerbils and hamsters, and now I have 5 hamsters or gerbils. I almost brought them this weekend to give away because I'm kind of tired of them. But, so get hands on, get things right in front of them. My students, once they know that you enjoy this kind of stuff, you can't get them to stop bringing it. This year, just 2 days or beginning of this week, Saban, one of my students, she brought in a plastic bag, and it was all tied shut. Well, actually, she called me the night before and said, I have a snake for you. Sphinx skin I found beside the road. I said, well, is it, was it dead? I mean, yeah, it was dead. So she brought in the next thing, it was all tied up in a plastic bag. And I said, does it smell? She said, yeah, it smells. So I didn't open it right then. I opened it later and it did smell. So I set it out behind the school. I'll let it, you know, maybe I'm not sure what'll happen to it. Maybe it'll dry out before I can get it. But you can't stop them bringing, things in. They'll bring, dinosaur eggs, and that's what I found out. It's a dinosaur egg. Does anybody know what it is? Ostrich egg. Now, tell them when they break it, not to use a hammer. Okay, one of my students pounded it with a hammer and almost shattered it and had to glue it back together. And when others see ostrich eggs, they'll bring you emu eggs. So you get all kinds of, you get your students involved when you have hands-on things. Number two there, plan a curriculum based on the seasons. At least this is what I do. You can't really go by the order in your books. If you go by the order in your textbook, often you'll get to insects in the middle of winter. You can't study insects in the middle of winter. Or you'll get to maybe flowering plants, you know, at the wrong time. So what I do is this. I do botany in the fall. Okay, I study botany in the fall, and then I do anatomy in the winter. And for those, you're doing a lot of lab work, dissections, so on. So anatomy in the winter is fine. It's snowing outside, you're okay. And then I do zoology in the spring, studying animals, and that's when a lot of the amphibians start coming out. When spring rains start coming, they can bring frogs in, and, you know, and all kinds of stuff. So zoology works pretty good in the spring. And then late spring, early summer, before school lets out, you get into insects. So that's what I found is a good schedule. Now you'll need to rearrange your books. Often I found most textbooks, you have to rearrange the order of the chapters. But don't be bound, at least I found, don't be bound by the order of the chapters in your books. That was one man's way of doing it. Whatever works for you, put it in order. Decide what you want to cover, and then see how you get shot. You could do insects in the fall as well. In fact, in the fall, like up to now, they might have been a little more prolific than in the spring when they were. But then in the spring, you have a trade-off. You don't have as many flowering plants, or they don't have as much time. So I found working with flowering plants in the fall is best. Let's go ahead into botany, and I'll just share some of the things that I found work for me. One is doing a plant collection. And I had to do this when I was in college. Maybe that's why my students always are. They accuse me of, I worked hard in college, so now I'm making them work hard. That's good. Okay, you get ideas and then you make them do it too. One of the things I did is, I learned to enjoy plants. And I had cress and mount, I think it was 100 of those. And I'm only making them do three this year or so. Let's talk about plant collection a little bit. Students really, really enjoy this. Even the guys, you know, at first, all flowers and wants to pick flowers. But have them learn to properly do this. What works best, I think, is to have them learn some common flowers. If you look on your second sheet, or the last, you have a whole row. I put four small things on one there. If you look on there, you should find a list of plants to know. And that's for my 9 and 10 biology students. Those are plants that are found commonly around school and around their homes. And that's not an exhaustive list. That's just a start. That's a scratch on the surface. And some of those are common. They know them already. Many of them they do not. But start with that. It's a good start. Have them learn some plants that are just around the place. And you can go out and have them. There are several ways you could do plant questions. You can have them, one is you can go out and have them teach pictures for plants and then come in and identify them and look through the keys and find out, oh yeah, this is goldenrod. Or you can give them a list and send them on their own. Okay. I'm doing that this year. I'm giving them a list. I'm saying, you go find them. So So you look down the list, okay, I know what Ophiuchus is, I can check that off. Well, I don't know what ground shares are. So they have to look ground shares up in the book, you know, read about them, then you have to go out and find ground shares. And most of the plants that are in flower right now around our school are the ones they're learning. So it's not as hard as it sounds. Or take jewelweed, which is touch me not. It bursts when you touch the seed. You don't know what I mean? So that's the only plant that's blooming in the back of the school. The woods and the border of the woods is jewelweed. So I have them go out and I say, no, you just go out and find all the plants that are blooming and figure out what they are. Most of them are on this list. So that's the second way of doing it. One way is to tell them or have them bring, you know, 3 or 4 in, everybody key them out and we'll talk about it. I think I did that the other year. And that worked out real well. Or you can set them out on your own and make some learn how to use a key, a flower key, a flower book. And the kind of books I use are ones that are friendly for students. Now I have these big fat, you know, botanical taxonomy books, but they don't know how to, of course, don't know how to use those, and it's fine. But just get the little golden series, or Audubon puts out, you know, photographs. Peterson has some good books. So your basic field guide kind of books, and the Golden American series is excellent. They were using them on Friday. I was going to bring them along. They were still doing them this year. So, and then they can learn the plants. The other thing you want to remember with a plant collection is proper tools. And let me just go over some of the tools I use. It doesn't take much. The things I'm going to show you today, I'll talk about at the end, the cost and how you can get them. But most of them will not cost you much money. For a plant collection, really all you need is you need to press the plant to make it dry it out. So I built just out of plywood, and I put holes in there for ventilation. And then you can also buy potting paper, which I did. I bought some, you know, for $10, so you can buy some, you know, dolling. But what works well, and perhaps better sometimes, is using newspaper and fold it in half and have them lay their flower in there and fold it over. And then they need to put that in a press. And if you don't have a press, just use books. Half of them, they end up on the hall of the school. And they have these big, you know, National Geographic encyclopedias. Probably the only time they ever use encyclopedias. So the idea is to get them pressed. And then I put bricks on them. You can also put straps around them. I've seen some that have another strip here, then they put carry bolts in and screw them down. So lots of different ideas and methods. The idea is to get the plant pressed flat. Then when it's pressed flat, they mount it. Oh, I have to do it that long. They mount it on a piece of white paper. And this is bought mounting paper for herbarium. It's herbarium mounting paper. But if you don't want to go to the expense of buying, you can buy like 100 sheets for, you know, I'm not sure what they cost. But it's not that expensive. Or you can just get plain white paper, get a heavy paper that's heavy. I'm not sure where you find it, but you can probably find it around somewhere. And cut it into, you know, equal sizes. And it's nice to have about 17, 18 inches so that the plant will fit on well. And then I always stress the proper sequence. Maybe you should write this down, but I have it on your paper. The proper sequence is to collect, then identify, then press. Yeah, I have that written here. Each collects, identifies, presses, and mounts. In other words, that's pretty, because some of my students, they come to me and they have this beautiful plant mounting there, and I want them to key the plant out, right? So they have this beautiful plant mounting there, and they don't know what it is. And I tell them, well, I can maybe help you, but if they bring plants, I don't know what plants, you know, there's lots of plants out there, there are no flowers on them, and it's hard to tell. So have them identified before they go to mounting it on, or they're going to have to, you're wasting paper, wasting time. That's a good sequence to collect, identify, press, and then mount. Then you need to they need to glue the plant on, and that's really
pretty easy. You can use Elmer's glue.
I bought some herbarium glue this year, which works well too. But just something to glue it on and
have it so it's
nicely displayed when they're done. Then on the bottom left-hand corner, you can get these little cards that tell you the genus name, the scientific name, the genus, species name, the common name, the locality, altitude, date, habitat, their name, and some remarks about the plant. So you can get these, a whole stack of 100 for a couple of dollars as well from any supply house. Or you can make up a pre-design and have them type it up. Should be done easily. I make them type it. They hate typing these, but you know, they're small and they don't go through the typewriter or anything, but it's a good experience for them. But having to do it neatly and then mount it properly like that. And then as far as storage goes, it's important that they're stored properly. I keep them from year to year. This is the first year actually that they're doing this type of mounting. But we're going to be keeping them in our school herbarium, but you have to put mothballs in them and insect weed. Okay, so just put them, stack them. Some people put clear plastic over them. I'm not sure I'll do that or not. But put mothballs in them and keep them year to year. Then next year students can look at how they did it, you know, and they can add to the collection. Maybe even make them plant plants that weren't in there. I have some up here. You're welcome to come over to me. Come afterwards. Plant tree identification is kind of on the tail end of this. Have them, that would go along the list I gave you. Have them collect or identify common plants. I'm astounded how many students don't know what an oak tree is. They don't know what a maple tree is. And they have no idea. And is that a hickory? So have them learn common trees around the place. And to do that, guess what? You'll have to learn first. So maybe you have to get out your eyes and brush up too. In your books, when you start learning compound leaves and simple weeds, the book is no place to learn compound leaves and simple weeds. It doesn't make sense. So go out and flex on and have them. Is this a compound example of compound leaves? Have them explain, well, this is compound because there's one stipule coming off the stem. On there you have, you know, many different leaflets coming off. So that's the best way to learn. Such lessons. And one of the best ways to get them to do it is through having a plant and tree identification project. Another way you can have them learn about things is to do flower dissections. And maybe I'll skip this. Do you want to run back to the... I have something to sink over in the water that I forgot to bring. So we'll come back in this a little bit. Let's just get started with that list of miscellaneous exercises. These are some things that I've really enjoyed doing to my students. Characteristics of monocotyledons, dicotyledons, better known as monocotyledons. Go out and get, shake off the roots. Have them learn that a grass seed, and I didn't bring my grass plant to you. You shake off a grass plant, what do you have? What kind of root system do you have? You have a fibrous root system, the branches, right? They see it in the book, but it doesn't stick. Okay? You pull out the plant, shake it up, and bring it in front of class, they'll remember much better. Have them, I do have a tapping system here. So what's the difference between this, and you hold up this half root, and a fibrous root? Well, it's quick to see. This has one main taproot with smaller ones branching off, whereas the fibrous root is, you know, looks very massive here. Another thing, also then with the monocots and dicots, you can have them learn the shape of the leaves, the venation. Like on these, the veins are on dicots. The veins are often patterned, okay? They're branching, whereas on a, they don't run parallel with the stem as on a monocot. On a monocot, a grass plant, the leaves are going to run under the venation, it's going to be parallel with the stem.
Thanks.
We just did a flower lab in school.
I had So that's one of the things that are monocots and dicots, is bring things in. That's what I'm trying to stress. Bring things in. All it takes is a walk in the woods. And I enjoy that anyway. So just go out and pull stuff up and bring it in. I try to bring things on. Steve said he tried to do demonstrations. I try to do, you know, bring stuff like this in. And they get all excited when they see stuff they didn't leave around. Especially your elementary. This cannot be stressed enough. They 5, 6, 7, 8, they love having hands-on things. 9 and 10, you know, it starts, you know, fading away, but you can still get them interested. And then they have to start with that next let's step back to the flower. One of the best ways to learn flower parts, I think the only way, is to actually get a flower and learn it. You know, you can teach it on overhead, you can draw them, whatever, you can have, but until they actually pull a flower apart and learn all the different parts of the flower, they actually don't understand it, I don't think. And you can do this easily. Just take any flower. I had them use snapdragons. And try to use a flower that's large. The lilies work about the best, a little bit. Or gladioles, hibiscus. What else do I have down there? Irises work well. I was able to get gladiolus this year. And just have them learn. And you learn about sepals, you learn about petals, and then we're going to tear this apart. Now, which is the stamens? Okay. And they have to learn with these 3 years of stamen. Okay, this is the pistil. And they have to learn. In other words, that's the way to learn. Then I have them cut it open on the bottom. Then they have to cut the ovary open. So when they cut the ovary open, I have them look at it, open it, and aha, there are all the ovules, all the little seeds. In this case, they're almost developed. So that's the best way I found to teach them. I mean, it comes abstract, they don't actually see it. And it takes only a minute to have it. These snapdragons, they're a little smaller, but you can easily see all the flower parts. If you have access to a microscope, you can even take the ovary and do a cross section, try to get it very, very thin. It's hard to get it real thin with a scalpel. But then if you put that on a slide and make a wet mount and squish it down, you can actually see the nucleus of the egg cell if you have a great flower. Try that on a few. Let's step back down to the root systems. Even corn seed sprouts. In other words, when you're studying seed structure and monocots, dicots, have them bring beans in. I know this is when they're fifth and sixth grade, or maybe in other words, 9 and 10th grade, well, we did that back when we were in third, fourth, fifth, and sixth. But tell them they have to do it again. And then give them a long list of things they need to learn structure. I think on your next page you have one of the labs should be the biology plant lab. And I have one there under seed structure, and they need to identify all the structures on the seeds. And I use bean seeds for dicotyledon, and I use the corn seeds for monocotyledon. And they need to sprout them. They put them in water, you know, make them moist, and put them in sunlight, and start sprouting. And then they need to bring the class. They need to learn all those parts. Seed code. They need to learn about the two cotyledons, the plumule, radical, phylum, and all that, and so on. And then that's a great way for them to learn the difference between a monocot and a dicot. And they can see it right there in front of them. Now, in other words, they may have done it in third and fourth, or fifth and sixth, but I bet they didn't have to learn all those terms. You know? And then, we're going to get this a little later, but one of the ways that you have to have them responsible for this is to have a lab on exam. I have lab exams. And for my lab exam, I use color pins. I believe in lab exams. In other words, not only should they have fun outdoors, but they're also going to have to remember this. Okay, they're going to have to remember this part. So it's a little hard to stick pins in some of these, but For the colored pins, I just stick a pink colored pin into a bean seed, into the chi leaf, and they have to identify the chi leaf. I pick it, beans would be a little hard to do, but you could put it to the hilum, or point it to the hilum, and you have to recognize that. And I'll explain these pins here a little more later. Another thing you could do is dormant twig structures, and on that same page, you have a list of dormant twig structures, terminal bud, bud scale, lenticel, auxiliary, which is a lateral bud, node, leaf scarp, and so on. And again, from a book, it's impossible. I mean, I remember you can't learn it. So take a twig, have them go out, and this is great, have them go out and get their own twigs, and they like that, and you have to make keep them in order, but get their own twigs. Bring them in and identify them. You'll need to use a little hand lens for some of these exercises. But if you have this simple magnifying glass, you know, they can look on the leaf stem and or the stem of the tree and identify most of these parts. Seed dispersal method is an excellent way to have, I did this year, and last year I had some too. This year I made everyone bring one in. And they had to bring in ways that seeds are dispersed. And this is, they love this because they, you know, it'll help them remember it. And so they have to go out and they find all the seeds that, you know, stick to you. You know? So that would be agent dispersal. In other words, they can learn the different ways that seeds disperse their fruits. Mechanical dispersion, I mentioned the jewel weed. That grows commonly around where we're at. And I brought some in class and touch it and it pops, you know, and you know, that's mechanical dispersion. So a lot of different ways of, you know, milkweed. You can bring a dandelion, blow it, and that's blowing through the air. You know, and have them understand, you know, those are all seeds. How do those seeds develop? You can have a class discussion on that. And when they bring things in, then it brings it more to life for them. Like when you're studying, for example, a Samara, you know, you could teach it out of a book, but it's much better to, you know, have it actually happen in class. You know, have them see how the ash trees and maple trees disperse their seeds, you know, in that fashion. I enjoy shelf fungi. I think that's what I'm, maybe that's just me. I have a big collection. I only brought a few along, but have things like when you get through your to your section in your books on fungus, fungi, you can collect some things like this and have them learn how that the spores go into the tree and you get a cross section. You can see how it actually ate out and then grew from the inside. And this is just the outgrowth on the outside. You can collect different kinds and they enjoy actually seeing it. Now, you know, now next time when they drive down the road, they're going to remember you had this symbology lab and they're going to remember the lesson you taught them how it grew from the tree. While we're on fungi, you can do other, like just this morning I went out and found this little mushroom growing out of the, just a wet piece of wood. You can go out and have them, I would suggest they don't collect too many mushrooms because of the poison and so on, but have them go out and just see the abundance that are in the woods. But if you do quite, make them wash their hands. You can get sick in a hurry from eating. Or even some are toxic enough if you touch them, don't want to grow them sick. And also mushrooms should, it's a good idea not to disturb them. It's better to leave them untaken. You can do tree cross sections. I have one of those here. When you get to the point where you're studying the kinds of, summer wood and spring wood and all that, boy, that becomes burdensome, you know, unless if you can actually, okay, now look on here and you can teach them, you know, spring wood is wider, thus wide, and then one's more moisture, it grows faster. And some of it is darker. Why is it darker? And you can teach them about xylem, and the xylem cells are closer together, and so on. But the best way to do it is, that I found, is bring things in. And you have to watch it, because often if you bring things like this in, I'm sure maybe you've noticed that some students tend to get lost in the shelf and they think it's free time. So I have to try to get everyone involved, and that's why I make them responsible by giving them a lab. You know, I give them a grade on it. So it's not just a free ball, they have to be responsible for what they work. On a tree cross section, there are many, many things that you could teach from actually bringing. You can teach the medullary rays, and they can actually see that. Whereas if you're in a book, you see it on a diagram, but it usually looks different to grow light than it does with a diagram. Spore prints are fun to do. I don't know if you've ever done them or not. You just take in this case, you would gather a mushroom, and you would cut off the stuff, and then you put it face down, so the cup side is on top, and you leave it overnight, and usually the spores will be released. And then you come back the next day, the next morning, you do that on a piece of paper, and you take it off gently. Then you can put like hairspray on it or something, and it leaves a spore print, the shape of the mushroom, and then you can teach them how to spray a spore, release their meaning and go on. So in other words, when you're into that as an anthropologist, it's good to have them understand the intricacy, how many thousands are being released, and you can do that with spore print. I enjoyed last year, I had advanced biology, and we enjoyed growing molds. Now, we grew molds. You can grow them on cheese, on bread. I had some food that had been laying around. We brought that in, we were looking at it. Just exciting ways that you can bring things, I think, to life in your class. You read about molds, and they know about molds, but if you bring them in, and we have a dissecting stove, which is like a 40 power. And you can look at some, you get them to look at bread mold on their dissecting stove, it opens their eyes. And here's this little, looks like a stick hanging up with a big ball on top. Wow, I didn't know that's how bread mold looks. And you can teach them about fruiting body and lots of other things. You can grow algae real easily. We had a fish aquarium at school, and you know, it starts getting green, and you take out take a water dropper and get some out and look under the microscope and see what kind of algae you have. I have two photosynthesis experiments you could do. One of my students did this last year with the color of visible light. She took the same plant, and then she put cellophane around it. One was clear cellophane, one was yellow cellophane, one was blue, and I think another was green. And then she subjected them to the same amount of light, and then she saw what the different growth was, different rates of growth were of the plant. And then you can, from that, deduce, okay, well, which light do plants use most? The chlorophyll, which end of the light spectrum do they use most? You can go in and teach them that. Another way you can do with photosynthesis is to take a water plant, Elovita, and there's another one actually, it's Anacharis, and you can take and break the top stem off, put it underwater, and then put a funnel over it underwater and a beaker, and then the bubbles. When the plant starts doing photosynthesis, it will release bubbles underwater. And you can measure the rate of photosynthesis by how many bubbles are being released. Almost any textbook will have that experiment. Any lab book will have that. Another thing I've done with plants I've taken them out and done a four search. And I made a square meter plot. I have them, last year they took a string
and they measure the square meter of the string. They go out in the woods and peg out a square meter. And then in that square meter, they have to find, they have to identify as much as they can in there. This is an excellent way to learn what all's in the woods. You know, they have to separate it into the man-made things. You know, they'll find new man-made things. They'll find plant life, animal life. You can, depending on what level it is, you have to make a key out and what kind of plant it is, what kind of insect it is. But even for younger levels, it's good, because then they have to see, wow, all this stuff is in this little area. That's an excellent thing to do. You can, you collect, sort, identify, there's also a lot of recycling. You can teach them how that the recycling takes place, decomposition, the building up of forest litter, so lots of great things there. You can contrast field and the forest. You can do the characteristic plant life in both, or in either, each. What evidence of animals, how does the amount of light determine what grows there? So that would be an interesting hands-on thing for you to do with your class. Let's go to zoology. We had first thing I usually do when I get to zoology is I make them say it right. Most people go around and do zoology. Make them say it right. I guess for me, I enjoy collecting the skull. You know, so once you start, once you have them understand, you can be fun. You know, they'll start bringing skulls in for you. I think all these are good. I'm not sure all these are. A lot of people brought these in. But I like to have things laid around. I tell them, you know, well, I have, what kind of skull is this? And I have to look at it. Well, somebody guesses, you know, find out what's a button box, you know, so you know it's a button box. Then because you see the shape of the, his nose fall off. But, you can see the shape of the skull, then I can hold this one up. Well, what's he? What's it? Well, obviously he can tamper with it, so they guess, well, he's a fox, so I'm gonna cut it, you know, his hand. So, just a lot of, small things like that. I like to have, a turtle shell laying around and, you know, it'll get that big, and it'll get bigger than this. That's like a turtle. And, you can, when you study structures and, when you study animals, animals tend to be, when you study them in a book, it tends to get kind of boring. And this is a place where I like to have them keep lists of birds and, get out and do the actual thing. What I've chosen to do here is go down through there and give you, I have dissections, first there. I guess I can't really stress enough that, that dissections are a bare necessity, I think, to biology. If you're using them, you know what I mean. If you're not, let's just talk about dissections a while. And that really is a bare necessity to any biology class. And I know when I was in school, I went to an ACE school, high school, and we hardly did. So when I got to college, I was full. That's the first time I saw a frog in a plate. I mean, I had done some of my own, you know, so on, but we, but you can, even if you're in ACE school, you can supplement it with dissection. And I mean, and if your school doesn't have a schedule, dissection, you know, bring it in. It's not hard at all. So why don't I talk a few things, a little bit about some of the basics I've learned with dissection. You need a few basic tools. And dissection kits are very inexpensive. You can buy these from any biology supply house for $7 or $8. Yeah. And even if you take them, if you don't want to spend that, you can buy the individual thing for less. So this stuff is standard. You can find it on the ground. And so have them, I usually try to have about one dissection kit for every two students. During labs, I have my students work in pairs of two, and at the most three. I usually don't like to get much larger than that, or somebody's not doing anything. So about two, at the most three. And so, yeah, tool. The basic tool you really need is a few dissection instrument, and then you need a pen, just a dissection pen. And I have some in the car I'm going to give away, and there's some over here. So if anyone do not have dissection pens, I have some that are around. I would give them to me, and I'm going to use them. But the old ones have the wax, and the new ones have a nicer rubber on the like a synthetic material on the bottom that you can just take out and wash and rinse away. So if you're going to buy them, you might want to consider getting that synthetic material. The wax ones you have to melt down every so often. You either have to melt down if they have last year's perfume or maybe that's part of being a having a topology, getting to write your name on the wax at the bottom. So the new students, they won't, or the new generation, they'll be proud of that privilege to get the synthetic material. But, yeah, that's the basic, just a dissection pan, a few tools, dissection tools, and then the basic guidelines for labs, the ones I set up, are to have the basic guideline is to do it yourself beforehand. I found this out the hard way in some of these too. But do the dissection yourself. And I come in and I cut open this. I must have done it before, but cut it open, look at it, make sure you can identify it. Because it does look a lot different in the real one than on the paper. And they will have done the question. So that's number one. Do it yourself beforehand. And then in addition to that, have a photograph available of the dissected specimen with the label. I usually give them a handout when they come to lab. I have them read the lab before if they have the lab manual. In our school we use, and some of you have seen this, and use a backup. And I supplement it. I don't use it entirely. But when they come to school, I give them a piece of paper. And I don't think I included one on your on the back there. But I have one in here. I think I ran out of it. I have one in here. I'll pass it around. And what it has on it has a list of all the structures they're expected to learn during this lab. In other words, this is more than just cutting open the frog and seeing the frog. By the end of the lab, this here is particularly as a birth form. You're going to have to identify these five things. Internally, you should identify these things. And it's kind of a check thing. Do I know what the body can seal? Do I know what septum are? Can I find the channels? So in other words, can I put check marks there? I'll pass this around, and you can. That's what I found very helpful to me, because in here they have a lot of terms, old terms. Do I have to know all this? Well, some of them are very hard to find. Some, you have to. So you have to give and take. And if I give them a little piece of paper, I start off writing on the board, but then some of them would write them down. It helps me to hold them more responsible by giving them a piece of paper. They're responsible for it. Later on when the board is erased, they go back to their notebook and find out what they need to know. Along with that, I would, before I start a lab, give any precautions or words of wisdom. Now, when you do this frog, when you cut it open, you might see, in other words, help them beforehand to know kind of what they're getting into. An example of this would be with the crayfish, when they do the crayfish. When you take out, in your book, it's going to tell you to take out, all the appendages. And they're going to be small. In other words, point out a few things that they need to do. Now, it's going to look like this. And kind of have them come to lab not having a free-for-all, or it's not just a free-for-all time, but have them come, sit down, expect to take from some notes, and then they have to go to work based on what you told them. I don't give them too much time in class. I don't know what y'all have found out, but if I give them too much time in class, they tend to fall. That's what I found, just practically.
In other words, if
you're trying 5 days to do this, okay. Just, I don't necessarily tell them, but I gauge myself by the best student. In other words, if my best student takes, he's my diligent student, one's conscientious. How much time does it take him to do the dissection? And then you kind of gauge yourself. And then what I do is I require it for homework. In other words, I have the stuff all out in the back of the science room. If they don't get done, they have to do it in the study hall for homework. Their problems they do felt in class. So I don't give them terribly much time to do their labs. I try to give it, realistically. But we've got other material to go on to as well, so that's not take all our kind of time doing, cutting up the problem. Maybe a question would be, how much do you dissect? I do have a course syllabus along. If anyone wants to see mine and my schedule, well, I plan to get done this year. I'm not sure about your old other now. I'll have it up here afterwards if you want to see it. For this year, just to give you an idea, I have written down on your paper, I think, a basic, I think, would be an earthworm, a frog, bony fish. If you're an advanced course, you have field pig, rat, starfish, crayfish. You can even do a cat, grasshopper, and quite a few others. I enjoy dissection, so I tend to go a little heavy on it. And we do sheep brain. It's excellent. When we study human brain, it's no better than to pull out a sheep brain and have them learn all the parts as many as you can. I do tend to go a little heavy on the labs, on the dissections. Now, just to finish up here, how are you going to hold them responsible? And this is the way that I mentioned to you earlier, I use colored pen. So on lab exam day, it takes more time to use than you know. But you come in early and you take all the frogs they dissect. Now don't let them cut and mutilate their frogs up, you won't have any frogs. Okay? So don't tell them to pull anything out and not cut anything out, but have them do the dissection the way they're supposed to. Then on lab exam day, you have to come in, you have to take lay out all these frogs that they dissected. Hopefully they dissected them correctly. Then I take colored pen and I go down my list and I put a colored pen. I say this frog will be one station. And by this station, I have 3x5 card. And on my 3x5 card, I'll have green, black, blue, yellow, white. That's all it is. And so they have to come in here and they have to look at the white for number 8 and the green pin. What's that? They then have to recall. For number 9, it's the black pin. What's that? And they recall. So my lab exam, they have a total recall and they have to be able to spell it. And now this is for 9, 10, 11, 12. They have to be able to spell and recall each term they learned. So that's the best way I think to do lab exams. Put pins, color pins, have them learn. Otherwise, I don't know if they will. Some of them will, some of them will. But if you have to, then you can try to. I think that's all I have for dissections. Is that? I want to open it up a few times. Does anyone have any points on dissect, something you found out that works for you that I haven't been doing? As far as testing, or just methods getting started. I guess I can't stress enough, just the importance of doing it. That they look back at their high school career, I call it a career, and they'll always remember taking that scalpel and cutting open that that muscle, and they'll remember the hardest thing to do is find the adductor muscle, right? And cut it open. But once they found the adductor muscle and just cut it, and that thing will pop right open. And then you can teach them the manifold. And you can teach them how your adductor muscle has to pull the shelf shut. You can cut open the manifold. You see the stomach. And it's just, there's no way to do it, I don't think, without, I mean, if you're going to teach a lot of zoology, there's no way to do it without actually cutting it open and showing them, here's a site, okay, here's where the muscle takes in the water, and here's the external site, and notice where the anus is located, by the external site, so the waste can go out with the water as it comes past. Teach them, and then look at the heart here. What kind of heart system is that? So there's a lot of things you can, I think you'd miss if you didn't actually get these in. How much do these cost? Is that what you're wondering? They don't cost that much. I don't have them memorized, but frogs tend to get more expensive. You can buy them in groups of, I buy them in groups of six, I think, or 12. And we usually have a couple hundred dollars in lab, you know, dissection specimens. But for a year. But I think it's well worth money, well spent. There are things you can do, you can bring them in, okay, from like earthworms, you can bring in yourself. And the problem with bringing things in is what? They're gone, and I mean, you have to do them one day and get rid of them, or they're going to smell. And so, right away. I think there are also state laws on what you can bring in. And so I try to be a little careful with that. I know one of my students wanted to bring in a beetle, a deer had gotten hit, she wanted to bring in a beetle. And I.
There are permits you can get for that.
Okay.
Probably a king protector, I'm not sure.
So you might have to check your local, or state and local laws on that. But there is value in that. I do that sometimes. I bring things in, like a bird's been hit. I bring it in, we'll look at it. Not necessarily cut it, but I know one time we found a mouse, and it was dead, and it had a huge bulb. And we were trying to figure out what causes bulb. So my biology student came outside, and we went, we got a dissection pan out, we cut it open, and its bladder was hugely, I have no idea what happened. I don't know if it, maybe it ate a chemical that caused it to have a distended bladder. I'm not sure, but they'll always remember that. They'll always remember the mouse had a distended bladder. I mentioned collections under paper ready for, on your handout there. Collections. I mentioned a lot of these already. This is the kind of stuff that I enjoy. Many of your students will never see a worship crab. So, try to find one. I find a crab to teach them out there. And, when you show them, never eat the sand out. You shake and shake, the sand always comes in. I'll have my tail here. But show them horseshoe crab when you study that section. It's real nice to have. So I kind of where I go, I end up boxing in the science room. But when it's time to show them, it makes a graphic lesson come alive. When you study birds, we show them a bird skull, and they see the it's through light, They can also compare skull, compare a bird skull with a mammal skull. Quite a few different things you can do with a collection of that sort. I have insect collection, and I personally enjoy entomology, so that's my one of my hobbies. And many of these are mine. Okay, I don't have all these later like I should. When I was in high school, I had to do some, so I had a lot of popular labor. I'm not going to give you a whole lot of guidelines for insect collection. You can find almost anywhere. The best place you can find out how to do one is if you you don't have a Bible that tells you. It's fine to get field guide. Go to Storm by Peterson field guide to insects, or you can buy Golden Guide, or quite a few. And in the back, or in the front, they'll tell you all about golden. They'll tell you about what kind of nets you need. They'll tell you about pins. I did pray to get them all. But this is, students loved it. Seventh and eighth grade. This is his right. Then you'll learn about, you put your blocks out. So, you can find them if you've never been exposed to this and you don't know where to start. I would buy a field guide. It tells you all about mounting them, tells you about killing jars and what kind of chemicals you should kill them and so on. And, your students will get excited about insects. We find you. They love insects. I shouldn't say that. They all start off thinking insects, oh, bugs, or you cover them out of their mouth of bugs. And you start telling them about, scavenger or diving eagles, and they say, wow, eagles in the water. You get, they could become alive to them. They love to see your big eagles. So I tell them, if you find a big eagle, I'll give you more points. I think on your handout, I have the rules for my insect question. I think I posted on there. These are just ideas to get you started. Okay, you can adopt them. You can do whatever you want. Adapt them. Do whatever you want. But these are some things that have worked for me. I had a point system there. I think next time I'll alter the point system a little bit. But let's them, what kind of grade you want, what all you want to work for. And I brought it on to my students' work. I have it in the box. So they get into it. Some of them really love it, some of them don't. But generally, they do fine job with insects. And insects, again, are, once you start teaching them the numbers that are out there, you can quickly stagger their minds. They can appreciate the beauty that God gave them. Along with the zoology here, one thing I've enjoyed doing is having a classroom aquarium in the back and just having them bring in stuff from home. I went out this morning and I caught a nest egg. I see now there's beetles running on here. They didn't know. There's a boy caterpillar. They'll quickly start, filling it up. Now, you have to be careful there. Again, there are state laws as to the size of your snakes. I personally don't enjoy snakes. I have anything bigger than that. I'm not a first problem. So I'm not in snakes anyway. So, but I'm turtle. I think they're the size of a turtle, so they can carry bacterial disease. To check those out, I think you're safe if you just bring a little, turtle. And I know we had one turtle. No one will ever create the turtle. We had them all year, kept them all winter. And he did hibernate that. But we enjoyed having him in our classroom. So try to make things like that come alive. There's also a lot you can do with mammals. We have gerbils. I have some gerbils. You have to keep them cleaned out so they don't smell the room. Things like that, students, they love it. It helps them learn about helps them work on the school. I know one little guy he's actually ninth grader. At least last year and some of this year. First thing he did in the morning he came to school.
Tearing up to my room.
Yeah, he'd go in the back and he'd play the drums, which is fine. I didn't mind playing the drums as long as he didn't neglect those things. But having atmosphere in your classroom of just learning. I know one teacher, or a lot of teachers, especially in fifth and sixth grade, they had a table that's designated for nature table. And they had put in
the children bring in,
bees, pine coming in, anything natural, they just put on the table, and it gets to be quite a collection there. That's maybe an idea if you're working with younger groups. You can do field drills.
When I go, when I get into zoology, I require a field journal. I have to keep a notebook of all the animals. Like, generally, zoology, you do divide it to vertebrate zoology, animals, sea animals, a bird, a spinal cord. Then you can have invertebrate zoology. So what I do when I get to vertebrate zoology, have to track all the animals that they've seen. That's another idea I got from high school, college. I had to do it, so I'm intended to. And that's what I'm looking forward to having to do this year. Just keep a little notebook. And every time you see an animal, see how many kinds of animals, and give me credit for it. By the way, we're not talking about earth science this weekend very much, but earth science is another way you can, this year for my earth science class, I'm having them write down all the non-living things. And that's quite a challenge. In other words, a lot of things out there are life. This is a living planet. And a lot of things out there are, there aren't that, in other words, you start getting rocks, and they want to, can I write bark down? No, you can't write bark down. That was once alive, or, so from a plant. It's become a challenge to do some of these. It makes them, it opens their eyes, their observation, their powers of observation. It makes them responsible for what they're doing. Okay, I have some miscellaneous ideas I'm just going to go over. Owl pellets. I collect these from my parents' barn in Virginia. Owls, when they don't digest everything, they spit it back up. Okay, it's called a pellet. And what you can have them do is you collect some of these and dissolve this, clean it up. Something you can pull out little rodent skulls and come take a look. Actually, you have a bowl, some sort of a bowl. Okay, you can. In fact, did you know scientists use owl pellets to study the population and what kind of? It's incredible. There's another thing with skulls. Each skull is totally different. You can tell exactly what species of bull or whatever they're studying, whatever they're eating is by looking at these. So most of your students, you probably don't want to get into it, but explain this is a cough up, and that helps you, that consoles them a little more. This is a cough up. And I'm going to keep these, we're going to do those this year. Now, in here, there are little insects in here. That's another study. How decomposition of the organic matter and so on. The food chain study. In other words, what did the voles eat? They ate some grain or whatever. They ate plants. What's eating the voles? The owls. So you can study a little bit of food chain. You can incubate chicks in the classroom. We did this last year. In fact, one of my students did it for a science project. So every day or every 3 days, you crack one open and we put it in a formalin solution in a preserver. And amazing, this progression. Even on the first or second day, we had a beating heart there. You see the heartbeat in the chick embryo. Nature table and classroom, I mentioned that. Collect pond or stream organisms. You can do a lot with food webs, insect metamorphoses, dragonfly larvae. They have this little mouth that comes out, grab things. And so you get them to collect these and look at them under the hand lens. You have a dissecting scope. That's nice. There's a lot of things you can do with pond organisms. I went down this morning and tried to. They got some pond water. I've been trying to find a little. I didn't know what I thought these protozoans, but I haven't found them yet. I found some real nice sand green in the worst time, but maybe we can find some more later. These are some ideas I got out of the pamphlet here. Invertebrate scramble. You can search for invertebrates. In other words, zoology, some of the smaller animals, mollusks, worms, insects, crustaceans. This morning I found a bunch of these little pillbones, you can call them, little crustaceans, you can teach them how well they need water too, so they carry water with them, when they're around, so that's why you find them in wet places.
you won't find them dry places and die. So they carry water with them.
You know, they have little gills under their body and so on.
Do a lot with invertebrates. Wild animals, you could build feeding stations, watch for wild bird flocks, build nesting boxes, so on. When we get down into anatomy and physiology,
what I have done here,
when I first started teaching, I didn't have really very much equipment. I went to a local butcher, and he gave me some eyeballs, and that's where I got some beef eyes, and he did that for some universities as well. So this will be an eye opener if you've never done it. In other words, like I mentioned Mary, she didn't know that gooey goop was in there. I didn't know that was in there. It just helps teach students of structure. So, and some of them want to take, they want to take your whole length and they take it home and bounce it around.
So there's a lot of
neat things you can do inexpensively.
I didn't even check that one out. I've been thinking about it. Is that legal to put together a cow eyeball? I don't know that there'd be any restrictions on that. Maybe you should check that out.
But I think for things like that, you'd be okay to bring those to school. They're inexpensive.
Fine. And then if you put them in here, in that formaldehyde's formalin solution,
it preserves, keep it from year to year, and it's a nice conversation.
You can also do the brain. When you study the brain, I mentioned that sheep heart. I don't think I've brought a sheep heart along. We have sheep heart. Now, bone and muscle lab. I got to get to Bob here.
I'm going to talk a little bit about how you can get things, get some of this equipment at the end. I can acquire something. And one of the ways I acquired a lot of this was from the university. And I went to Bob Jones University. When I graduated, when I left, they were just in the process of renovating their science department, and they were throwing away a bunch of this stuff. And one of my professors asked me, "Hey, we have this skeleton. You knew I was going to teach me. We had this skeleton, and we just wondered if you'd like to have it." I was like, "Sure, I'll take that." Okay. So he gave me Bob. We call him Bob. So we call him Bob, and actually, Bob is an actual skeleton. You won't be able to find actual. You can't buy actual skeleton more or less today, which is fine. But I think there are some things on an actual skeleton you can't. Some of the structures that you can't, especially if you're in advanced biology, you're studying, say, the skull, the different openings in the skull, and so on. There are some structures you can't quite replicate on a synthetic one, but. For Bob, he was kind of falling apart. He was falling off the table. It's just, the basal bones were all crashing. But I fixed him up the best I could, and I left most of him at home. But what I want to show you is, just to say on a hand, if you could all have access to a model, there's just no better way than to, to teach how you're, when you turn your arm flat, you have to try. And you're teaching the focus. Why is it going called legs? So why is this called the ulna? So there are a lot of ways you can teach bone if you have bone to teach. Now I don't know if probably those people are making skeletal models. It's excellent to have skeletal models. That's the best way. I'm missing a humerus. I had one model, I had everything but a humerus. So, but I always have them still have to know what their humerus is. So I had all of me hanging in the back of the room, and I'd be hanging on the table and sit over there, and all of those. Now, if you don't have that, what can you do? I still think there's a lot of bones you can do in the bottom. What you should do is you can have them on themselves. Okay. Go in, and then they have to have a checklist. All of them.
They have a mental checklist. They have to call them. The colony is fine, but they are on glad again they have to break. Not necessarily the colony. So that's, if you don't have a Bob, I'm glad I have a Bob. It makes it a lot easier. But they cost like $700 to get my work from this farm. But you collect a,
next time you see a dog or a cat, collect it. You know, get your students to help you. You can get some vermested beetles and eat away the flesh. Then you have a nice little, having to piece it together. Some of the ones with small bones would be hard.
I wanted to show you,
while I'm on the subject of bones here,
come look at this afterwards. And this is a bat. Okay. I found a dead bat and I put it away, and here are some of the bones that are left. And just incredible. The intricacy. You see some of the wing bones there, so small.
You can do a lot on anatomy and physiology tends to become textbookish, you know, it's hard to, there's so much we can do, okay. But the dissections help them understand. If they can understand what happens to the frog, you know, what part of the stomach is this? Well, we're kind of the same way. In other words,
if they understand the structure on here, then it will help them, unbox. So that's where dissections come in very handy, studying anatomy and physiology.
You can also do readings. Have them read an article for every, each of the 10 human systems, and set standards, have them write reports, so on. I forgot my rubber bands. What I was going to do is there's some ideas that you could take a rubber band on your own local reports. Take a rubber band, pull it tight, have a big wide one. Okay, when you pull a big wide one and twang it, what's it going to be? It's going to be a load twang, right? Then pull a small, skinnier one, pull it tight and twang it, and it's going to be a high pitch. So then it helps them understand why, men have lower ones, women have higher ones. So some things like that you can do. I was going to take ideas from you that I think will, and you can fill in some more there, but I think we'll move on here. Microscopes tend to be expensive, and I like to tell you a story kind of near the end. Some things you can do in microscopes. And then I want to tell you after that story of how I got a lot of ours. There are lots of things you can do with microscopes. I guess the main thing if you're in an advanced biology class, prepare slides are a must. For a lot of your labs, you have to have prepared slides. So just, it takes some, initial expense, but have prepared slides where you can buy them and have, epithelium, three types of epithelium tissue. And I make them work. We have to look on them and have to recognize them. It's hard to do exams when you have only a few microscopes and you have 20 people. But I take the class, I have a work, I put the pointer on it, and then you take turns, they come through, and then I have a 5 microscope, and then I have the same 3x5 part, and I'll have name the structure at the tip of the pointer. And then you need to write it down into the next one. And I think last year in protozoans, we studied all the different kinds of protozoans. That's another thing. If you can get actual protozoan holders, it makes a world of difference. Get amoebas in. Get paramecia. Get euglenas if you can. If you can buy a whole mix from a supply house for $10, okay, don't ship them to you and have all of them. And you can identify them. It makes learning fun. They know that when they're going to get to advanced biology, they're going to study protozoans. They're going to be able to look through there and see things swimming around. It makes their excitement level, makes them much more anxious to learn, makes them a whole lot more eager to learn when they get to their classes. I use the prepared slides a lot. And then I also prepare a lot of slides. And if you want to buy like an algae set, it helps a lot. You can use, let's say when you get to diatoms or
some of the posterior, when you study how they do different ways that biology reproduces. These are preserved, so you pick out the drop before, and it only costs, you know, $10 or so for these. And you take out a drop before, you put it on a slide, wet them out, and you can look at it, and right there you are, and you have them every year. Every year. Okay. You can buy a lot of pulp too, and every year you can buy a lot of pulp. That's one thing you can do there. So yeah, there are a lot. I put just seven ideas there. There are more, but you could do your cheek cells, some introductory cells and the structure. You can actually see the nuclei as you stain it. You can do blood cells. I know when I last year my 9th and 10th graders, this is 7th and 8th grader. I guess like you poke yourself, put some blood on the slide, and they like that. So helps them not realize that, hey, what's running through me? It's these cells, your blood. Banana cells are excellent. Those are that's an excellent microscope lab. You can easily see the leukoplasts, and then when you stain it with iodine, they turn black, which means there's a presence of starch, right? There are a lot of things you can do there with animal or plant cells. I have Elodea anacharis. That's a water plant I referred to earlier. And if you take the tip of a leaf, a small leaf, and put it under low power on a wet, actually for this it might be good to get a depression slide. You can actually see cytoplasm extremely. You can see the chloroplasts taking a circle, and it helps them understand photosynthesis when you study plastids and so on. Pond water. Get the right in the summer and spring. But if you get the right drop, it comes alive. This stuff. I want to just here in closing. I want to give you some ideas of how I. We're all on limited budgets, right? You can't just go out and buy everything. So last year I was supposed to teach this advanced biology class, and I needed some microscopes. We had only one real good microscope, a light microscope, and it's a good one that was donated to us. These aren't top of the line, but what I did is I started calling around, and this is for any science student, I encourage you to do this. Start calling hospitals, and labs, and universities, and ask if you talk to the right person. They will have a supply room somewhere in the back that is loaded, shelled or loaded with microscopes that no longer use. They usually have to keep them for about 5-10 years after they don't use them. Eventually they're going to discard them. Often they may have a surplus store where you can buy it for a low price. In this case, these are from Bucknell University. I have 5 of them. And I talked to the right lady and she gave them to me. And they're not, like I said, they're not perfect, but they're fine. You can do a lot of these. You can actually tilt them up, and then these have a mirror on the bottom, and they're fine for our purposes. Now the light microscope we have, we need to use for some more detailed work. But I think you can that worked for me, and I also got a bunch of other stuff from college. Like I told you, I brought it when I left Bob Jones. They gave me boxes. Another thing you can do is call doctor's offices. You can get inexpensive model. The pharmaceutical companies give them this kind of stuff. Yeah. So we get to the evening here and we have something to show them. It makes it come alive. Or it helps them to learn it. They see it three-dimensionally. So when you call around, I just call around and told them who I was and asked them if there was anyone I could talk to. They used to refer you to someone. And it worked for me, and I think I'll probably be doing it some more. She was glad to give them to me. She said they have shelves of them, and they're being used by us. Another way that you can get some money for your stuff is have the students bring money. And here's how one here's how we cut it at our school, is have them bring a wound and canvas to school. And if every student brings a huge bag full of wound and canvas, you can turn it in, you can get $50, $60, $70. Hey, that's a start. You got some nice books before you do. And I know one person who even on my cooking, if he gives extra credit if they bring in a certain amount of wound and canvas, like very small. But you know, in his class, they don't want to do anything for extra credit, so they bring it in. So that's one of the initial factors. Have a jogathon. Our school is a jogathon, and last year we did a jogathon. We raised thousands of dollars, and some of that gets channeled in different places. So if you really need science news, have a jogathon. Get people responding. So we're trying to build up our science equipment school, whatever you're going to work on, and have people sponsor for now. There are also, so maybe to end here, there are a lot of things you can do with,
I told you
how I am on the, right to publishers. Okay, if you work at the school, most publishers will send you free samples. And, if you ask them, they'll send you all kinds of, up to date, latest, biological titles, faculty decide. And I make my grandfather's students in particular, I make them read, text I use. We choose them because they're Christian texts and brother. And so but they often there are supplemental information that helps learning become easier. So I have a reading assigned to you about other texts. And they put through here. A lot of these texts, frankly, are much more, they have more money, they put color codes in it, they could all be a whole lot better. So, that's a good way to have work. And then have them send you their lab books, their lab books. And you can look through here and get excellent lab ideas. And when you start doing sheep brain, heart brain, it's your first sheep brain and sheep heart. If it's your first time, you might be lost. Well, a book like this is really helpful. They have lines, especially if the teacher is additional and needs to be encouraged. So try that. Try getting a sample. Most publishers will send you a free sample. Some will not, but many will. Also, if you don't have a supply house catalog, like Carolina Biological, if you need a list of suppliers, why don't you stop by and let me know? And they all have 800 numbers. You can call them up. They'll send you a free catalog. You can look through and get ideas. A lot of stuff is inexpensive. Where you can get the shipment, often specialized stuff has to be shipped quickly so they won't charge you for overnight shipping. Just to finish off here, I want to show you just another way you can make learning fun in the classroom. Is by doing a little game with them. And I need one volunteer for this. So somebody want to come up here and we'll. He's got a feel that you can't look at him. And he's going to describe it. He knows what it is, he can't say it. He has to describe it and we'll have to get it. So this is great for outdoor things. So what do you got to mean? That's special. But thanks a lot. You can have a lot of fun with that. And it helps them to, like, when you review for something after they can fall. If you have them review, give them a vertical on the next time. They have to strive without sinning. Don't let them end this process. They have to strive without sinning. And so you can have a lot of fun doing that. And if you want to do outdoor activities, take them out and then have them each find something and do each other. They want that. That's the same session. And I have a whole list of outdoor games. It's from another. They're not mine, so I didn't have a big problem. But if you want to work more than them, you can get them all that back. I'll show it to you. Just one more thing I found this morning at the site. Lord, we're going to be so fun to bring it back. This whole Illinois.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit ChristianLearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the DocForLearning.org.